Hi, and welcome to the Provider Podcast by NHS Providers. My name is Adam Brimelow, and in this episode, we're capturing a really important moment for the new NHS England Chief Executive, Amanda Pritchard, her first speech in this role to NHS Providers Annual Conference. This was a strong and often heartfelt address, which rightly picked up a lot of media coverage. She spelt out the pressures that trusts and frontline staff have faced and will continue to face in the coming weeks and months, including the challenges of the vaccination programme, work to tackle the care backlog, and transforming for the future with a strong emphasis on workforce, digital transformation, and also prevention, tackling health inequalities. You can listen to last week's The Provider Podcast episode for our full analysis of the top messages from the conference. But if you missed the chance to hear Amanda speak, here it is now, back in full.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be joining you all today. It is, of course, my first NHS Providers Conference as Chief Executive of the NHS. And look, I'd just like to start with some thanks to you and to your teams. Thank you for your vital role in organising and delivering the response to the greatest public health emergency in a century. Thank you for, amongst that, continuing to prioritise the safety, health and well-being of your colleagues. And thank you on a personal level for your camaraderie, your counsel, and yes, your challenge too. The NHS has stepped up like never before over the last 2 years. It has shown, you have shown, our collective inability to innovate, to work in partnership with other NHS organisations and with local government and social care in particular, and most importantly, to put patients first when they needed us most. But look, we all know that the road ahead looks really difficult, but it is these past performances, what you and your teams have achieved, that honestly gives me confidence that we can rise to these challenges. So my focus for the months ahead falls into four areas: responding effectively to pressures over winter, maintaining our highly successful life-saving vaccination programme, continuing the recovery of crucial non-COVID services and tackling the elective care backlog, and fourthly, to keep transforming our NHS, to keep building on the beneficial changes we've seen over the past 2 years, with a renewed focus on prevention, on partnerships, on harnessing the power of data and digital technology, and on our workforce too, so that when we emerge from the pandemic, we do so as well placed as we can possibly be to face the longer term challenges we have with ambition and with well-founded confidence. I'll come on to just say a bit more about those priorities in the detail shortly. But first, I would just like to take a bit of time to remind ourselves of just how much we have achieved. I know it's really difficult to do this, but it's important we do reflect on these things and take pride in what we've been able to do. So we've all heard the saying that necessity is the mother of invention, and that has certainly been true. But actually, in many cases, we did have solutions identified and a plan to implement them already. But it's been the speeding up of these plans, the going further and faster, that's made a difference and crucially will continue to benefit patients in the future. So look, in particular, in the past 18 months, we have seen both the power of digital and data solutions and how quickly we can move to adopt them when we need to. There's been some fantastic work across the health service in lots of areas that have helped us and other staff to do their jobs more effectively, like the NHS data store, the software to support the vaccination programme. But importantly, there's been a really strong offer to patients too. Take tech-enabled access and care. We've made years worth of progress on rolling out the means to help people receive monitoring, support or treatment more easily at home. I mean, COVID oximetry and virtual wards is an obvious one, helping people to recover from the virus in their own home with the confidence that their condition is being monitored and they'll be called in if needed. But we've seen similar innovation in non-COVID care too. We've made tens of thousands of digital spirometers available, helping children and young people with cystic fibrosis to monitor their condition at home. By procuring a national video consultation platform for secondary care, we've seen a huge expansion in people choosing this option. And in fact, an independent evaluation suggested this avoided 2.9 million unnecessary hospital attendances and 35,000 emergency department visits in just 12 months. So that saves patients 2.1 million hours of waiting time in total. And of course, in primary care, we've rolled out things like take-home blood pressure monitoring, reducing the time patients need to spend in a GP surgery, as well as improving the accuracy of readings and the timeliness of interventions. In all these cases, NHS England and Improvement have provided the guidance. We've worked with government to provide the investment, but it is you and your clinical teams who've picked up the baton and run with it, integrating these solutions into your pathways and into your local practice. It is also you and your colleagues locally who've developed ever closer joint working between commissioners, providers, local authorities, voluntary sector, and other partners to deliver what's needed to be done in the most effective way. The pandemic has shown me absolutely that the principles of integrated care, of system working, and of partnership are exactly the right ones. They underpinned the operational response with mutual aid between trusts to ensure patients could access critical care. They've underpinned the effective discharge arrangements with social care to help people home as soon as they were medically fit. They've underpinned the greater collaboration between providers to keep other vital care going safely, such as the establishment of cancer hubs and surgical hubs. And they've underpinned our efforts to help the public stay safe, working closely with local authorities, public health and voluntary groups to get key message to those who needed to hear them, and providing support for the most vulnerable, in particular, to stay well in their own homes. And they've also underpinned the hugely impressive rollout of the vaccine programme. On the practical side, coordinating staff and resources, but perhaps most importantly, through the engagement and work with local communities, which has seen so many people come forward and get protected. So it is exactly those relationships which will be crucial to continuing to deliver on our long-term plan priorities and make meaningful improvements in population health in the years to come. So as I look back, this innovation and this partnership working are just two expressions of how you and your colleagues have done everything you could possibly do to put the needs and welfare of your patients first. I know that this determination, dedication and skill has brought to bear in countless other ways as well. The huge increase in critical care capacity, the upskilling and redeployment of staff to work in those facilities, the remodelling of hospitals, separation of COVID and non-COVID services, the rapid rollout of mental health crisis lines and alternative ways for people to access therapy, the acceleration of community crisis response teams, helping people avoid an unnecessary trip to hospital, the adoption of 111 online, 111 first, clinical assessment services, a far closer working between ambulance and acute trusts to ensure patients are able to access the right care in the most appropriate place. All of these measures and many more you have delivered at speed, but with the overriding focus on providing the safest and most effective care for those patients who have needed them. And once again, it is exactly that focus that will be needed to meet the challenges ahead. So I think we are all aware what those challenges are and where we need to prioritise our efforts. The one right in front of us is dealing with the current pressures. You can trust the fact that when you have told me, as many of you have, just how challenging it is on the ground, when you have described the rising demand for urgent care in A&E and the community, when you have talked about the intensity of pressures on our workforce, I have heard you and I feel those pressures with you. The number of COVID positive inpatients is heading in the right direction at the moment, though there are still thousands of very ill patients in our hospitals receiving expert care. Yesterday, 6,864. And we know, though, that even greater pressure is being felt in the non-COVID urgent and emergency care system as people come back to our services, having perhaps, for understandable reasons, stayed away during the pandemic. Equally, challenges at the back door in discharging patients to a very stretched social care system are meaning patients are spending too long in A&E, meaning ambulances are spending too long waiting to hand over patients, meaning response times are not what any of us would want them to be. and the indications suggest we are not going to get any let up for a while. So look, you will know that you have put in a huge amount of effort and resource into preparing for this, as set out in the 10-point urgent emergency care recovery plan. Some of the things in that include supporting 999 and 111 services to recruit more call handlers with an investment of £55 million and £23 million respectively, maximising availability of urgent care services to provide alternatives to A&E, improving hospital flow and discharge, particularly ensuring we've got those same day emergency care facilities and direct referral routes in place to bypass A&E where appropriate. For the first time ever, there is a primary care winter access fund, so £250 million for GPs and their teams to help make more appointments available over the coming months. But look, we know the next few months are going to be a winter like no other. So our collective focus must, of course, be then on patient safety. And I know this will be front of mind for everyone on this session. The vaccines are undoubtedly one of the biggest factors preventing a far worse situation at the moment, with the boosters helping to tackle waning immunity. So priority number two has to be continuing to deliver this crucial NHS public health programme. It is nothing short of incredible that you and your local colleagues have delivered 92 million doses in less than a year, including now over 11 million booster doses. Over two-thirds of eligible people aged 50 and above have now had their booster. And last week was a record one, with 2.1 million people getting their booster or third dose. But the job is not yet done. We know that still a third of people take between 2 and 5 weeks to come forward and book after we contact them and after they've become eligible. So we've opened up the booking service so people can book a month before they become eligible to make it as convenient as possible for people to come forward. And our message has to continue to be, please come forward as soon as possible when it's your turn. We've also just had the latest advice yesterday from JCVI on extending boosters to the over 40s, as well as giving second doses to 16 and 17 year olds. And I think we can probably expect further expansions in the future. And we are already thinking about how we can do annual booster vaccines if they are needed. And of course, we continue to make the Evergreen offer available to people who haven't yet come forward for any or all of the doses they're eligible for. So thank you for everything you've done to support the programme. And it just is vital that we continue to work together and that you continue to work within systems to ensure that vaccines are accessible for those who are eligible for them, but also that people have the trusted information they need to make an informed choice to come forward. And we know that NHS voices are amongst the most trusted and the best place to give that information and advice. But this isn't just about helping to reduce demand for urgent emergency care. The wall of protection vaccines gave us over spring and summer meant we were able to make really good progress on recovering non-COVID services. I'll just give you some stats. In the first half of the financial year, over 7 million people started elective treatment. That's 90% of pre-pandemic levels. Over 12 million key diagnostic tests took place. That's over 95% of pre-pandemic levels. And there were 1.2 million urgent cancer checks, more than the same period in 2019. In mental health services, more than 102,000 people started IAP treatment in July, compared to 88,000 the year before. Perinatal access has increased from just over 31,000 to just over 37,000 in March to July. And we're treating more children and young people with mental health problems than ever before. I mean, lots of you watching this session will have examples of how you've achieved these sorts of results and more. I know, for example, talking to colleagues just in the last few days, that Manchester University Foundation Trust has been able to reach 112% of pre-pandemic value-weighted activity levels towards the end of October. We know that there have been great examples such as Moorfields setting up surgical hubs to reduce the time cataract patients spend in hospital to around 90 minutes and carried out 725 operations in just 1 week. In Nottingham, you've launched things like Super Saturdays, where NHS staff perform the same procedure all day to reduce changeover times for equipment and staff. And of course, I've seen firsthand what many of you are doing to support the recovery of our non-COVID, of those services that were just inevitably impacted by COVID, and in particular to tackle the backlog. So, for example, at Milton Keynes, I saw how surgical robots were being used to deliver more complex surgery with faster recovery times for patients, less time in hospital, reduced risk of infection. But the truth is, we also know there are too many people waiting for care, and that's just the people who've already come forward. So priority number three has to be to do everything we can to build on the momentum we've already seen and get people, particularly those with the highest needs, seen and treated as quickly as we possibly can. But we all know the challenges. We know there are opportunities, though, to do things in a smarter way. Managing and expanding capacity through greater flexibility for staff, physical separation of estate, increased collaboration across systems and partnerships with the independent sector, better clinical and operational decision making through enhanced data transparency and integration, and leveraging the latest technology to facilitate access to expertise as and when people need it. We also know this is going to be a multi-year challenge. We have the certainty of a funding agreement covering the next few years. And as the Secretary of State set out earlier this month, the department is working with us and others to put together a multi-year elective recovery plan to tackle the COVID backlog. And we're hoping to be able to publish that soon. But you know what? There's no need to wait. And what's great is that I can see from the conversations I've had and from the data that I look at that you aren't. If you think you can go further and faster now, please do work with your system colleagues. And if you need to, talk to us about what will help, because we want to back you to be as ambitious as possible. So the fourth priority then is to carry on transforming for the future. This priority is obviously multifaceted, but it's got to start with workforce. The NHS has been, always will be, a people business. As I said on the Today programme this morning, nothing works without staff. So central to everything we do has to be supporting, growing and empowering our workforce. As we've set out in the first two instalments of the People Plan, what is within our gift right now is supporting the staff we have. And right now, that means continuing to have in place a strong health and wellbeing offer, particularly over what we know is going to be a very difficult winter. Top of the list, ensuring staff get their flu jabs and their COVID boosters. I know loads of organisations are very well advanced in delivering these. And to any colleagues who are yet to take up the offer, I would just urge you to do so as soon as you can to protect yourself, your families and your patients. And to you as leaders, particularly clinical leaders, it is crucial that we redouble our efforts to support those of our colleagues who aren't medically exempt, but who are still wavering on whether to get their first COVID vaccine, not just because of the intent set out by the government last week, but because we believe it's the right thing to do, because we care about them and our patients, and we want them to be as safe as possible. And frankly, we do need every member of NHS staff to be there for our patients. Beyond that, we know this has been an incredibly difficult period for staff. We know lots of great work has gone on locally to support staff health and wellbeing and continues to do so. So look, thank you to everyone on this call who's played a part in that, whether that's the million plus risk assessment conversations you held last year, the health and wellbeing conversations and plans that are taking place this year, or the countless local initiatives in many places working closely with volunteers, as well as protecting our staff from viruses and in health. Unfortunately, it is the case we must protect our staff from violence and abuse too. Look, we've worked with you to complement what you've been doing locally. For example, with the new mental health hubs for staff, they've been accessed over 32,000 times since March by clinical and non-clinical staff from a wide range of professions, and they'll remain in place to look after those who look after us. The national offer has also evolved continually across the course of the pandemic and will continue to evolve it, change it, improve it based on what staff tell us would help them the most. But support is not enough. NHS staff always find a way. Just look at the last 18 months. The determination, the resilience, the commitment has been absolutely breathtaking. But it is unfair to ask our staff to keep working so hard. We do need the right number and we need the right skill mix of staff to be able to deliver the models and quality of care we want to deliver for our patients. And we do need a workforce plan to deliver that. The Secretary of State made an important commitment earlier this month to finalise a long-term workforce supply plan by spring. And it's crucial we get this right. We will be working very closely with him and with other colleagues, especially in Health Education England, to ensure that it meets the future needs of the service. And in the meantime, clearly those things that we do to retain our staff by making the NHS one of the best places to work should also help us attract new staff too. We've got a lot of nurses and doctors in training, in fact, more this year than we've had before. The pandemic has driven a real surge in people wanting to sign up to medical and nursing courses, and it's our job to make sure that we've got the support and the training opportunities in place to bring them into the team as qualified clinicians, as well, of course, as welcoming in new recruits to any of the 350 different careers that exist within the NHS. International recruitment continues to be an important focus. Many of you are doing great work in this area and will continue to support that nationally. And locally, of course, it's one of the most important roles that ICSs can play, supporting training and deploying staff flexibly so that all organisations can benefit from the kind of flexible arrangement typified by the example I think NHS providers highlighted yesterday of the North East Ambulance Service paramedics performing home visits in support of local GPs and their teams. And that example for me also speaks to the need to continue to drive more care in and nearer to people's homes and to support people to better manage their own conditions. We can't just keep doing things the way we've always done. And I know no one wants to do that. We need to reimagine what providing community-based care means for the NHS. Starting from what it is that our patients need to stay well and keep doing the things they value, making better use of the kind of digital and technology solutions I described earlier will be central to this. I mean, the number of people who have downloaded the NHS app has skyrocketed over the last few months, now at almost 20 million. And that presents a real opportunity. Giving people access to the digital tools and the data about their own health can have a massive positive impact, not just on their ability to keep themselves well, but on their ability to play a full and active part in decisions about their own care and treatment. And look, we'll always be mindful of digital exclusion and literacy and the need to avoid entrenching inequalities in care. So that means ensuring that there are always non-digital routes available that are as good for those who want them or need them. So we should always strive, shouldn't we, to do with, not to do to. And harnessing technology should be about putting more power to choose into patients' hands. More fundamentally, meeting this ambition will need deep partnership between primary and community care and other organisations to provide a wide array of services outside hospital in a joined up way. The Health and Care Bill will be an important facilitator in developing these relationships even further than they already have been within the context of ICSs. And primary care networks, which have taken on such an important role during the pandemic, supporting primary care resilience in the vaccine programme, need to be central to this. And that's why I announced last week that Claire Fuller, many of you, of course, will know, will be leading a rapid piece of work to give practical advice on how PCNs can take their place most effectively within ICSs, forging those partnerships between primary, community and mental health services and other partners to really accelerate the preventative and out-of-hospital offer for patients in every part of the country. You'll be aware too, I think, the government are working on a white paper on how we can go further in our partnership with local authorities and social care post the Health and Care Bill. And we're expecting that white paper before the end of the year. But it's important that work continues now, particularly over coming months, supporting care homes in particular to keep their residents safe and well out of hospital wherever possible. We know that they and domiciliary care providers are really struggling, and they are going to struggle more this winter. Our fate in the NHS is inextricably linked to theirs. So anything we can do together to support patients to be safely discharged when they've been in hospital, and better still, to stay healthy at home in the first place, is going to benefit us too. There are lots of other ways that bringing services out into the community will help us address our other immediate challenges too. Implementing community diagnostic hubs, for example, already helping many areas address the elective backlog, delivering more capacity in more convenient locations for patients. The community crisis response teams, as I mentioned earlier, are already reducing avoidable ambulance conveyances to A&E. And where they're working well, social prescribers and other additional primary care network staff are supporting people to self-care and managing their own conditions, including working closely with the voluntary sector and other statutory bodies to get those people the wider package of support they need and reducing the need to call on many different parts of the system, but particularly GPs, as I saw recently when I visited Gloucestershire. So, you know, the opportunities in this area are really significant, and it's in the interests of every part of the system to ensure we work together to realise them. Continued transformation also means working to achieve the step change we want to see in preventing ill health and tackling health inequalities. It's become a well-worn phrase that the pandemic has really put these in the spotlight, which of course it has, but we've all been conscious of the need to take a more preventative approach on avoidable illness, which is the heart of the issue here, for a long, long time. It's writ large through the long-term plan and through many plans and reports preceding it. So another key thing that we're looking for from you and from other local leaders is, yes, let's fight the fires in front of us, but let's also remember that we have a job to do to help prevent fires in the future. I recognise it's not easy to do that at the moment, but raising our eyes to the horizon, even amid the daily grind of winter pressures and the pandemic, gives us a better chance of being able to come out the other side in the strongest possible state. And it means we remember that before the pandemic, we had other concerns which haven't gone away. Obesity is one of those concerns. It remains a societal challenge, impacting on our future health, our prosperity, and the long-term sustainability of the NHS. And that's particularly the case for children. The National Child Measurement Programme statistics out this morning provide extremely worrying reading. They show the prevalence of obesity in reception year has increased by almost 50% in just 1 year, and more than one in four children is obese by the time they leave primary school. Many children who are living with obesity or are overweight suffer or run the risk of physical and mental illness, including type 2 diabetes, asthma, and depression. These in turn can impact educational attainment and their future life chances, earning potential, happiness, and of course, longevity. And that's important because, according to the figures published last week, if you're a child living in one of the poorest areas of the country, you are 9 times as likely to have type 2 diabetes than a child in the wealthiest areas. And in fact, almost half of all cases of type 2 diabetes in young people come from the 20% most deprived areas. Inequality compounding inequality. So action we take now to support young people and their families to achieve a healthier weight will pay dividends for years to come. And that's not just about helping the NHS or our bottom line. It's for the whole of society, not to mention the individual lives we can change. So with that in mind, I'm pleased to announce today that we're delivering on our long-term plan commitment with the opening of 15 specialist childhood obesity clinics. These clinics will bring together multidisciplinary teams to give 1,000 children a year the support they need to lose weight and address other physical and mental health concerns, with the aim of avoiding the need for more serious treatment down the line. And they will join our growing portfolio of interventions for adults as well as for children in the battle for the nation's health. But look, as we know, you know, obesity is only one factor affecting the health of the communities we serve. Poor housing, air quality, lack of access to green spaces. With every year that goes by, we get more and more insight into how the vast majority of the determinants of health lie outside the NHS's traditional domain. That insight, of course, only backs up what we've known all along. Those of us who choose to work in the NHS, in social care, in roles like these, are motivated by a sense of public service, by a desire to do more to improve the outcomes and experiences of those who live and work in our communities. We can be the best in the world at treating things like cancer or heart disease. And in many fields, we are. We should be proud of that, continue to strive for excellence and make new effective treatments available as soon as possible. But the real prize, the real mark of success, would also be having to deliver far less of certain treatments because we'd intervened earlier. This is particularly the case when it comes to heart conditions, still one of the biggest killers and in many cases preventable. So as part of our continued long-term plan ambition to bring down those avoidable deaths, I can also announce that the NHS has agreed a new framework with suppliers that will allow us to roll out effective blood thinning drugs to more than 600,000 patients with atrial fibrillation. by using national level procurement to widen the availability of direct oral anticoagulants as alternatives to warfarin, combined with enhanced case finding and the excellent work already going on locally, we estimate we can avoid 21,700 strokes and save 5,400 lives over the next 3 years. So this is another example of the NHS taking a long-term view and working hard to get the best deal now so that patients and taxpayers alike can benefit for years to come. Transforming the future means making innovative use of data too. Data can help find, it can help case find for preventative treatment for conditions like heart disease, I've just said, or identify opportunities for proactive care, you know, such as those in Lancashire, South Cumbria, where they link NHS records with council data on assisted bin collections to find people living with frailty. Data can help identify inequalities, such as in Berkshire West, where they've been able to identify poorer outcomes among people in the Nepalese community with diabetes and provide a tailored offer to increase engagement with NHS services. And data can help drive recovery and delivery, such as the solution being used by Chelsea and Westminster to help validate and prioritise their elective waiting list and to maximise use of theatre capacity. We're now well into the era where having the latest informatics capability can be as important as having the latest drugs in your pharmacy, where an analyst could potentially save more lives over a 5 or 10 year period than an anaesthetist. Of course, it will never be either or, and some of our best analysts are also some of our best clinicians and managers too. And the data and the modelling, though, of course, would be little better than useless if there is no collective will or ability to do those things that will make a difference. And that's where having that flexible, supported workforce and those partnership working arrangements comes back in. Digital and data, look, need to be at the heart of our future, as they've been at the heart of our response to the pandemic. Being ready, willing and able to make the most of the opportunities they provide is at the front and centre of my vision for the next few years. And it does need to be, and I hope it is, a front and centre of yours too. So look, in conclusion, because I'm being wound up, but it's quite right. Anyway, these are my priorities. Look, I am clear that it's you and your system colleagues who are best placed to deliver on the vast majority of this transformation, alongside the many other ideas and priorities you have locally. From where I sit, we can give you the tools, we can share best practice, we can provide the financial framework, and we can support you to be as successful as possible. But I am determined this will be as streamlined and permissive as possible, because it's you who hold these local relationships. You know the needs of your local communities best, and you can give those communities a voice in decision making. You're the best people to judge what support you need to get you over the line. So it's your challenge to help shape the emerging ICSs, to be able to do that work and to realise the benefits and the considerable rewards that exist when we do get it right for our patients and our staff. Last week, I wrote in the HSJ that my first 100 days in this job have been characterised by realism, but also by optimism. And I am realistic. It has been very tough for the last 2 years. And in many ways, it's tougher now. And the signs suggest it's going to be tough for a while. So I've set out what I think the priorities are that we need to focus on to get through this period and hopefully come out the other side in some ways stronger. Dealing with pressures now and over winter, delivering the life-saving vaccination programme, continuing our recovery from COVID and transforming for the future, all underpinned by supporting our staff and working with others to ensure we have the long-term workforce plan we need. I'm well aware that each of these priorities and the things that sit behind those priorities is going to be tough to deliver. But as I said earlier, you know what, if you're worried about what the NHS can do over the coming months, then just look back at what it has done, what you have done since January 2020. Those achievements have been possible because our colleagues are exceptional. It's right we take pride in them, take pride in what we've delivered together for patients, because in doing so, we remind ourselves that there is a cause for optimism. We can meet the challenges in front of us and take the opportunities we have to focus on prevention, to work in partnership, to harness the power of data and digital technology, because it's those things that will help us keep transforming the NHS and the outcomes it delivers for our patients.
You
can join in the conversation by following us on Twitter and LinkedIn at NHS Providers with the hashtag The Provider Podcast, and keep up to date on future episodes by subscribing to the podcast. Thank you.